Today is the 4th, Easter Sunday. And of course, I guess you all saw the email that I sent out last night, and just reminding people that we are meeting this morning. But I was afraid my cousins are not on, and I thought they might not be. I don't know. But at any rate, I didn't want to lose our sort of train of thought since we quit right in the middle of things last time. What I'm doing is, I see also Pat Nevin's log. I don't see him either. But what I'm doing is simply...
I'm here, Don.
Oh, you're there. Oh, okay.
Oh.
I see. Okay. I'm going over the, laws that... The Quran, of course, is not a book of laws, but it does have Leviticus-like passages in it. And all I was doing was, I went through and I probably found a resource online. I just don't remember. Oh, there's Bob. So I went through all the ones that I saw, and I pulled out ones that I thought were representative. I mean, in other words, this is not a exhaustive list of laws or anything like that. It's simply good examples of the kind of thing you do find in the Quran. But we're right in the middle. And also what I did, I found another resource, I guess, out there as well, which is helpful because it classifies the laws into five groups. And we're simply going through the five groups. And, you know, the first group was purely religious laws, laws having to do with worship. And that's very similar to things that you find in the Old Testament about, for example, how you do sacrifice, and then how the tabernacle is to be set up, and various dimensions of this, the Ark of the Covenant, all that sort of stuff. Broadly is, how one is required to worship God. So you have the same kinds of laws in the Quran. Then you have, all these dietary laws, which once again are similar to the things you find in the book of Leviticus. You find what you call ethical laws, moral laws and injunctions, especially things like, don't lend money at interest, don't take advantage of people in your business practices. Stuff like that. Those we would classify nowadays as simply moral injunctions. And then we're right in the middle of number 4, and there seem to be more of these than anything else, and that's domestic laws, laws regarding the family. And we covered last week a whole slew of those. And then the very last one that I had wasn't right. And I realized it wasn't right as I was reading it. And so then I went back and I found my original document that I had done all this work on. And I discovered I had misread an 8 as a 4. And so instead of 54, 2 through 5, it was really should have been 58, 2 through 5. So, Jay, you can correct that in your in your notes there. And so let me read that. That's the last of the family laws that that I was going to present here. And so let's look at that real quickly. 58, 2 through 5. Allah has indeed heard the speech of her who pleads with thee concerning her husband and complains unto Allah. And Allah has heard your dialogue. Verily Allah is all hearing, all seeing. Those among you who put away their wives by calling them mothers, they do not become their mothers. Their mothers are only those who gave them birth, and they certainly utter words that are manifestly evil and untrue, but surely Allah is the effacer of sins, most forgiving. As to those who call their wives mothers, and then would go back on what they have said, the penalty for it is the freeing of a slave before they touch each other. This is what you are admonished with, and Allah is well aware of what you do. But whoso does not find one, he must fast for 2 consecutive months before they touch each other. And whoso is not able to do so should feed 60 poor people. This is so that you may truly believe in Allah and his messenger, and these are the limits prescribed by Allah, and for the disbelievers is, of course, a painful punishment. That's the way it always comes out. So this has to do with women who feel unjustly treated, I suppose, by their husbands, and men who accuse their wives of.
64 people are fast for 2 months.
What was that again? Oh, I thought I heard somebody say. People who accuse their wives apparently of adultery. I mean, I think that's the gist of the. They put away their wives by calling them mothers. And if they do so falsely, then they need to do X and Y and Z and the whole deal about very specific kind of penalty that's involved there. So that's the last of the family law. So we have a fairly good representative sample of the kind of things that you find in here concerning the family. Okay? Any comments, questions, or observations or anything like that? Okay. The last group of laws I classified as civil or civil and criminal laws, and I just have a couple of examples here. The first one is Surah number 2, verses 179 to 183. So let's go back there. O ye who believe, equitable retaliation in the matter of the slain is prescribed for you. The free man for the free man, and the slave for the slave, and the female for the female. But if one is granted any remission by one's brother, then pursuing the matter for the realization of the blood money shall be done with fairness, and the murderer shall pay him the blood money in a handsome manner. This is an alleviation from your Lord and a mercy. And whoso transgresses thereafter, for him there shall be a grievous punishment. And there is life for you in the law of retaliation, O man of understanding, that you may enjoy security. It is prescribed for you when death comes to any one of you, if you leave much wealth, that he make a will to parents and near relatives to act with fairness. It is an obligation to those who fear God. And he who alters it after he has heard it, the sin thereof shall surely lie on those who alter it. Surely Allah is all-hearing, all-knowing. But whoso apprehends from a testator a partiality or a wrong and makes peace between them, the parties affected, it shall be no sin for him. Surely Allah is most forgiving and merciful. So this is several verses, but it looks to me like they articulate a couple of laws here. I mean, the first one has to do with retaliation. And interestingly, it's very, very much like the law of Hammurabi. You know, a free man for a free man, a slave for a slave, or a woman, a female for a female. So, in other words, if you kill my slave, then I can kill your slave. Even though the slave had perfectly innocent, but. Now, that's the way it works. But then the escape clause here is, well, blood money can substitute for retaliation. So, and really, that's still done in Muslim countries. That's done by the U.S. government in Afghanistan, right? I mean, you read about it in the newspaper. Air raid, you wind up killing 10 innocent people, and then the U.S. government pays blood money. That's a way of getting around, just the eye for an eye type thing. And then the other part of this has to do with wills and, last testaments and that sort of thing, and the altering of wills and, you're not to do that, obviously. Alter the will in your favor so you get the inheritance from the deceased. and there are severe penalties for that. So that's what these, and that's why these I would classify as civil or criminal laws. And the other one is 24, 28 through 30. So let's look at that. 24, 28 through 30. O ye who believe, enter not houses other than your own until you have asked leave and saluted the inmates thereof. This is better for you, that you may be heedful. And if you find no one therein, do not enter them until you are given permission. And if it be said to you, go back, then go back. That is pure for you, and Allah knows well what you do. It is no sin on your part to enter uninhabited houses wherein are your goods, and Allah knows what you reveal and what you conceal. Okay. Well, that has to do, obviously, with breaking and entering, as we would say nowadays, or just entering somebody else's property and regulating that sort of thing. So we have examples then of all five classes of laws here, religious laws, dietary laws, ethical laws, laws regarding the family, domestic as I call them, and civil laws. So that's a nice, I suppose, overview of these various laws. Does anybody have any comments, questions, or anything like that before we move on?
Don, okay. Is there anything in there about sort of how the laws are enforced or anything like that?
No, not really. Not that I recall. I mean, you heard a few minutes ago, and in several cases, the penalties for infraction are very finely laid out. Other than that, I don't know of any other practical sorts of details about them. Yeah. Anything else?
Yeah, Don. There were lots of references last week and today about slaves. Hmm. About how to treat slaves. So when it came time to ban slavery, my recollection is the Muslim world had a difficult time because slavery is, I wouldn't say endorsed, but it's certainly allowed by the Quran as long as you treat your slaves properly.
Mm-hmm. Well, same as the Bible. I mean, that's what Paul has to say about slaves, treat them nicely. I do not know historically about. I mean, I know a fair amount about the abolition of slavery, in the European world and here in the U.S. I don't know what the analogous events in history were regarding Muslim countries. Does anybody know?
Well, they were later than the West for the most part. Mm-hmm. That's certainly true.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in the West, you're talking, first half of the 19th century, basically, I think. I mean, the U.S. was a little bit later, but not too much than that. I don't know. I couldn't give you any dates or even decades for, anti-slavery in the Muslim world. It had been a part of Muslim society and they just got it, I'm sure, from what was before, forever. There was never a time that it was not part of society, because it was part of the ancient world too. I mean, it just sort of inherited that. Yeah. Anything else?
Because Don, because one thing I don't really understand is, since there's no. The leaders of the Muslim world, let's say the religious leaders, not the political leaders, since there's never another prophet, are the leaders, like the Mormon church, my understanding is the head of the Mormon church is considered a prophet and can say that this is the new rule, I've been spoken to by God. The Catholic Pope can always say some things.
Mm-hmm.
But the key people in the Islam religion, do they have the authority to say God has said this or Allah has said this and it's now true? Because that would make them a prophet.
No, not really. Not at least in the mainstream versions of course, Islam, there are lots of splinter groups. And but no, I mean, now you can have a caliph, of course, who is has a certain amount of authority as a partly religious figure, but the authority is more like the Pope's. I mean, the Pope doesn't say, "Oh, God just spoke to me, and by the way, forget about what Zachariah said. God just said, throw that one out. You know, this is a replacement." No, I mean, even if the Pope is speaking ex cathedra, it's supposed to be an authoritative interpretation of what's already there, and it's fixed and it doesn't change. And you never go any farther than that in Islam either. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so...
Yeah. I mean, that's
I don't
not...
know how they can do a real official change in policy.
Well, I mean, it's a lot like, in some ways, somewhat like, it's like the Catholic Church minus the Pope, maybe, something like that. I mean, even Sunni Islam is not as centralized as say, the Catholic Church, which is highly centralized, or even the Orthodox Church. But you do have very influential theological schools, and they have a certain amount of clout just because of their authority. But I mean, it's always a matter of the interpretation of the Quran. Now, of course, as you know, I mean, think about Christianity and think about all the wildly different ways in which the Bible has been interpreted. So, I mean, you may have a text there, but that doesn't necessarily rein in, radically different interpretations. and it's true in Islam too, clearly. I think the Quran is more unified than the Bible is, simply because of the tremendous diversity in biblical authorship that we have. And even if the Quran, even if some scholars are right and the tradition is wrong, that Muhammad was not the or the only author of it, still, I think you'd have to admit it's a lot more tightly integrated than the Bible is. As you go through the Quran, I have to tell you this. Now, I don't see Marty on here. But anyway, I'll talk about Marty anyway. I think they're out in Michigan this week. But, actually, Erica's here. And Erica, I think, is in Marty's group. I think she is. And, the reason Marty and some others in her... She has this little group that she... They read things and then they get together and talk about them. And so it just, by chance, were thinking about reading the Quran. And it just, at the same time that I started this year, just totally by chance, no coordination at all. And so they were doing that for a bit. And then I was chatting with Marty several weeks ago, and she said, we just quit because it was just, it got to be so repetitive and so boring. And but that is indeed true. I mean, you read the Quran, even if you read it chronologically, as Randy and I did, and as I would advise other people to do. I can remember getting back with Randy and, here we go again. I think we've been over this about five times now after we were in it for several months. And that just is because the Quran is very, very much the same thing over and over again. It would be like taking a single book of the Bible and, expanding it out several fold. That's the kind of feeling you get. And so the Quran is much more integrated, in other words, than the Bible is. So I could well believe it by one person. But anyway. But I mean, I think that might constrain the number of possible interpretations. But still, history has shown that there have been a number of ways of construing the Quran, as I will be mentioning in the upcoming weeks. So let's move on to jihad. I know as Americans, we're all, wondering about what does the Quran have to say about jihad, for goodness sake, because of the 9/11, I don't think we've gotten over that yet. And so I'm going to read you I have here an exhaustive list of, I think it's exhaustive, of jihad passages. And there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 21. I think I counted that right. 21 passages in the Quran that have something to do with jihad. So this, think of this as an exhaustive rundown of jihad, and you can make up your own mind what the Quran says about jihad. And anyway, now the thing to remember though, and this is really, really important. Let's go back to the life of Muhammad just briefly. You know, Muhammad received his, what, first revelation in 610, I mean, when he was 40 years old. and then things kind of settled down for a while. He didn't get anything. And then they started coming again, and things kind of accelerated from there. But he, you know, Muhammad, of course, started off in Mecca. He was a Meccan citizen. And when we organize the surahs in the Quran, or attempt to at least in chronological order, we divide them into four historical groups. The first three of them are Meccan, right? Early, middle, and late Meccan. And the difference between those three is, by my lights at least, negligible. The big difference is between the Meccan ones and the Medinan ones. You know, eventually he had his safety deteriorated markedly over time. It just kept getting worse and worse. You may remember that, first of all, he was sort of abandoned by his tribe. They rescinded the general shield of retaliation. In other words, if you do anything to one of our citizens, we're going to go back and do this, you know, that kind of eye for an eye sort of thing. They rescinded that for Muhammad. Why? Well, because he was upsetting the apple cart. I mean, you know, the tradition, the religious tradition, as long as anybody could remember, had been polytheistic. And here's this guy coming around telling us that this has been wrong for centuries? Come on! You know? We're not going to protect you anymore. I mean, we'll outright kill you, but, you know, you're kind of a persona non grata. And his position deteriorated year after year after year. He sought protection in a neighboring city. Those negotiations fell through. So finally, in 622, you know, which is the beginning of Islam, I mean, that's where that's like zero, he fled. He fled to Medina, somewhat north of Mecca. And then, of course, you may remember, I went through over all this back in the beginning. Warfare broke out between Mecca and Medina, and it was a back and forth kind of thing. The Meccan forces thought they could stamp this heresy out immediately. They attacked the Medinans and were defeated in battle. And then the Medinans thought, well, we can, you know, snuff out the opposition immediately. And they went and attacked Mecca and were defeated in battle. So then they arranged this truce, which lasted just a couple of years. And then it was broken, each side accusing the other. And then warfare broke out again. But this time, in 630, the Medinan forces captured Mecca. That was the end of the resistance. And then Muhammad lived for two more years and oversaw pretty much the conquest of the Arabian Peninsula. I mean, once they got on a roll, they just kept going. And pretty much the conquest of the Arabian Peninsula. Anyway, the Medinan surahs in that fourth category are in the last 10 years of Muhammad's life. And there's more of a difference between the Meccan surahs and the Medinan surahs than there is between any of the periods, the three periods of Meccan surahs. That's really important. And it's particularly important when you're talking about jihad. Why? Well, of the, if I counted it right, 21 references to jihad in the Quran, guess how many come from the Medinan period? Of the 21 references, 20 come from the Medinan surahs. One comes from a Meccan surah. So that should tell you something right there. Clearly, I mean, we've seen this over and over, of course. You know, we've seen how, for example, Muhammad will project onto some ancient prophet, Noah or Moses or, you know, whoever, his own issues that he had himself encountered in dealing with the polytheists. You certainly get the sense that the kinds of objections they would be supposedly voicing against a prophet were exactly the same kind of things that Muhammad encountered in his own preaching. And so it maybe shouldn't come as a surprise that all of a sudden the militarization of this new religion gets reflected in a more militant atmosphere in the later surahs. So that should, you know, it shouldn't be a surprise at all. Those later surahs then were written during a time of war, whereas the Meccan surahs were not. And that's really pretty important. So, I'm going to let you be the judge as to what you think. Yeah, I'm just going to read you the evidence and what you think about jihad. I mean, is jihad, you know, is violence an endemic part of Islam, as the detractors of Islam would hold, or at the other extreme, is the Quran simply saying you should wage a jihad in your heart? You know, you should, you know, all that means is, you remember, jihad actually is one of the five pillars of Islam, right? I mean, you know, you're supposed to, affirmation of faith, you know, and the pilgrimage and prayer and almsgiving, and then jihad. And that seems like an odd man out, you know? But at the other extreme from the contention that jihad or violence is an endemic part of Islam, at the other extreme is, no, jihad is just simply a matter of, as it were, waging war within your heart, and fighting against, you know, temptation and that sort of thing, and trying to make yourself a better person, whatever. So, yeah, what is jihad? Well, you be the judge. Yeah.
I have a question based on things you were saying. Is it possible that the Quran was organized in by the length of the surah,
mm-hmm,
as a method of avoid, instead of chronologically, to avoid the tonal shift that must have happened?
Yeah,
by spreading it out.
Right, I get it. Well, maybe. I never took it that way. I mean, of course, your guess is as good as mine as to why it's arranged the way it is. But I thought one possibility is totally unrelated to that theory. And that is that, okay, the idea was, well, if you're not going to read the whole Quran, at least let's put the most complete expositions of Islam up front, so you at least get that. And, you know, then the other works, it comes out as working out details or something. I mean, that's just speculation too. I don't know, but you know, I guess it's a possibility. But I really don't. I'm not sure that they were all that worried about jihad, or that people might be offended by jihad or something like that. Back when,
well, not necessarily just jihad, but just I mean, that had to have caused like a shift in tone, and I mean, not just.
I see.
I would assume not just with jihad.
But yeah,
with
nothing, yeah.
Result. Move.
Yeah, but you know what? Sort of the side effect of the organization by length rather than by date kind of reverse it. It's kind of like reverse chronological order is the side effect of it. because most of the early surahs are really, really short. And as you go through, they start getting more and more wordy. So it's almost like a reverse chronological order that winds up being the side effect of the way they decided to arrange them, for whatever that's worth. Now, on the other hand, you could say, well, no, what they wanted to do was then highlight the later ones, you know, because they would be more authoritative than the earlier ones. You know, you could go in that direction too, rather than diluting or obscuring the difference between the early and the later surahs, you know, which is what you're suggesting, I think. So I don't know. But yeah, that's interesting. I don't know what happened to Erica. She was on before, and now I don't see her. Well, anyway. Let me read the one Meccan reference to jihad. And that's 25:53. It's only one verse. 25:53. Here we are. So, obey not the disbelievers and fight against them by means of the Quran. A great fight. Okay, that's it. Now, I did not arrange everything else chronologically. Everything else I just arranged, you know, according to its order, as I have been doing anyway. You can consult. I could have actually gone through, I guess, my spreadsheet. You could consult the spreadsheet if you want to, you know, if we can detect some sort of development within the Medinan surahs as opposed to between the two. But anyway, that first one is, well, I'm not sure it's talking about violence at all. It's talking about fighting against disbelievers, but that could mean, you know, a lot of things. Anyway, the next one is back to surah number 2, 191 to 194. Alrighty, 191. Here we go. And fight in the cause of Allah against those who fight against you, but do not transgress. Surely Allah loves not the transgressors. And kill them wherever you meet them, and drive them out from where they have driven you out. For persecution is worse than killing. And fight them not in and near the sacred mosque until they fight you therein. But if they fight you, then fight them, such as the requital for the disbelievers. But if they desist, then surely Allah is most forgiving and merciful. And fight them until there is no persecution, and religion is freely professed for Allah. But if they desist, then remember that no hostility is allowed except against the aggressors. Okay, and this is in the context of other things you do around the sacred month and spending for the cause of Allah and complete the Hajj. This is really in the context of other of the pillars, the six pillars of Islam. But fighting in the cause of Allah is one of them. Okay, same surah 216 through 217. Here we go. They ask thee, why am I doing this? Oh, yeah. I don't know why I said 216. Well, anyway, I'll just read them both. They ask thee what they shall spend, say whatever of good and abundant wealth you spend should be for parents and near relatives and orphans and the needy and the wayfarer, and whatever is good for you to do, surely Allah knows it well. Yeah, okay, fine. But anyway, the next one is, I don't know why I said 216. 217. Actually, it's 217 and 218. That's what it is. Ah, I'll have to fix it. 217. I must have copied this from... Okay, never mind. Here we go. 217 and 218. Fighting is ordained for you, though it is repugnant to you. But it may be that you dislike a thing while it is good for you, and it may be that you like a thing while it is bad for you. Allah knows all things, and you know not. They ask thee about fighting in the sacred month. Say, fighting therein is a great transgression, but to hinder men from the way of Allah and to be ungrateful to Him and to hinder men from the sacred mosque and to turn out its people therefrom is a greater sin with Allah and persecution is worse than killing. And they will not cease fighting you until they turn you back from your faith, if they can. And whoso from among you turns back from his faith and dies while he is a disbeliever, it is they whose work shall be vain in this world and in the next. These are the inmates of the fire, and therein they shall abide. So that was 2:17 and 2:18.
Don, at the beginning of that passage, you referred to fighting in the sacred something, and I wasn't sure if it was month.
Yeah.
Mosque.
It was, I think, month, right? This is the beginning of 2:18. They asked me about fighting in the sacred month.
So would that refer to Ramadan?
Yes.
Okay.
But then the next thing you know, they're talking about the sacred mosque also in that same verse.
Right.
You know, so both. Okay. That's from Surah number 2. Now, Surah number 3. 170 to 172. I'm going to make sure I got my verses right. You know, sometimes when I get these off from another source, as you know, the verse numberings are not consistent. And a lot of it depends on whether you include that very first verse, whether you include as the very first verse, the intro into a surah, which, you know, is always in the name of Allah, in the name of Allah, the gracious, the merciful. Is that going to be included as verse number one? And it is verse number one in this edition, but a lot of the time it's not. So sometimes, you have to be careful. The numbers are like one off sometimes. So anyway, surah number 3 verses, let's see if this is right. Yes, 170, 172. Think not of those who have been slain in the cause of Allah. Well, actually, no. Let me back up. Sorry. Once again, I'm going to be real careful here. 169 and 171. So let's back up. It is these who said of their brethren. No, I'm going to back up even more. Sorry. Now I see 168. Holy cow. Okay, let me start at 168. And that he might distinguish the hypocrites. And it was said to them, come ye, fight in the cause of Allah, and repel the attack of the enemy. They said, if we knew how to fight, we would surely follow you. They were that day nearer to disbelief than to belief. They say with their mouths what is not in their hearts, and Allah knows well what they conceal. It is these who said of their brethren, while they themselves remain behind, if they had obeyed us, they would not have been slain. In other words, if they had avoided fighting, they wouldn't have been slain. Say, then avert death from yourselves if you were truthful. Think not of those who have been slain in the cause of Allah as dead. Nay, they are living in the presence of their Lord, and are granted gifts from him, jubilant because of that which Allah has given him of his bounty, and rejoicing for those who have not yet joined them from behind them, because on them shall come no fear, nor shall they grieve. So there you go. And by the way, well, the context of these is misfortune. And the immediately preceding verse, 167, which actually starts the sentence, I should have said 167 to 171. That was 170. Yeah, 171. 167 says, that which befell you on the day when the two parties met. And there's a footnote here. This is the Battle of Uhud. The Battle of Uhud was the second of the... Remember I said there were two initial battles. When Muhammad fled to Medina, the Meccans attacked. They figured they could quickly stamp out this heresy. And they were amazed that the Medinan forces won. That was the Battle of Badr. And that was in 624. And then the same thing happened the other way around. The Medinans then thought, well, we can, you know, stamp out the rebellion easily. So they attacked the Meccans, and they were defeated. And that was the Battle of Uhud in the next year, 625. Okay. The footnote to verse 167 says, the Battle of Uhud. So, 167 is, so I should have started there. So I have to fix my notes. I'm sorry. And that which befell you on the day when the two parties met, i.e. apparently the Battle of Uhud, in other words, when they lost. So that pretty much dates this set of verses here, right? Was by Allah's command. Of course, because, you know, everything is only if Allah wills it, right? Was by Allah's command. And this was so that he might distinguish the believers, and that he might distinguish the hypocrites, which is where I started. That's 168, right? And it was said to them, come, ye fight in the cause of Allah, repel the attack of the enemy. And they said, if we knew how to fight, you know, but we're not going to do it. And then, you know, so forth and so on. So the entire thing is 167 through 171. That's sort of the complete thought there. And you could include 172 too. That's just more about how great it is to be in heaven with God. 167 to 171.
And what surah was that?
That was number 3. 167 to 171. And the next I have listed is 196. I probably did not go through and make all the corresponding changes that I should have made to make them line up with this edition. Let's just check this thing. Yeah, this is okay. Let's see now. So their Lord, this is still Surah 3, by the way, 196. So their Lord answered their prayer, saying, I will allow not the work of any worker from among you, whether male or female, to be lost. You are from one another. Those, therefore, who have immigrated and have been driven out from their homes and have been persecuted in my cause and have fought and been killed, I will surely remove from them their evils and will cause them to enter gardens through which streams flow, a reward from Allah, and with Allah is the best of rewards. Okay, well, this is just a verse, you know, promising among various other favored groups, those who have fought and my cause and been killed. So these would be martyrs, right? And that's why, you know, the fundamentalists, you know, they get these people who are willing to, you know, put on explosive vests and stuff, verses like this, but, you know, this is what's going to happen to you. You know, if you fight in the cause of Allah, you're going to be enjoying the most amazing rewards.
I downloaded a copy of the Quran a few weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
When you started this, I did a search on jihad, and I came back with zero hits. So I went to the index, and I went to jihad, and I have 6 verses that reference jihad.
Uh-huh.
And the ones I've gone into don't even have the word jihad. They might talk about war or a strife. Is that just cleaning up the Quran?
I have no idea. I mean, I would imagine if you hit 6 verses, maybe the word in Arabic, jihad, is only in those 6 verses. I'm not sure. I mean, you don't have to necessarily use the word jihad to be talking about jihad, you know, fighting
right
in the cause of Allah. So I'm not sure about that, but if you take down the ones I'm citing, now,
yeah,
remember, your version of the Quran could be 1 or 2 verses right off, but
which
you'll find it. You'll find it in that general region. Yeah.
Yeah. You had, for example, you read from 2553. Well, I found it in 2552.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it doesn't have the word jihad in there.
No, that was just talking about fighting in general.
Yes.
And does it have the word fight in your translation?
I think,
I think it's not as it strife.
Strive.
Do not follow the disbelievers and strive hard against them.
Yeah.
On behalf of a mighty striving.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. That kind of thing. Okay. The next. Let's see. I finished three. Now, Surah 4, 75 through 77. Let's make sure that that's really right. Let's see here. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah, exactly. So that's okay. Surah 4, verses 75 through 77. Let those then fight in the cause of Allah who would sell the present life for the hereafter. Right, once again, these great rewards. And whoso fights in the cause of Allah, be he slain or be he victorious, we shall soon give him a great reward. And what is the matter with you that you fight not in the cause of Allah and of the weak, men, women, and children who say, Our Lord, take us out of this town whose people are oppressors, and make for us some friend for thyself, and make for us from thyself some helper. Those who believe fight in the cause of Allah, and those who disbelieve fight in the cause of the evil one. Fight ye therefore against the friends of Satan. Surely Satan's strategy is weak. So whoever's on our side is on the side of Allah, and who's ever on the other side is on the side of Satan.
Don, it doesn't seem yet that in what you've read so far that there's a distinction between fighting defensively and fighting offensively.
Well, you could take the one I just read. Yes. Let me just say, of the various interpretations of jihad that are out there, I mentioned two extreme ones, right? One extreme one is of the critics who say, look, just read the Quran, you'll see that violence is an essential component of Islam. It's irredeemable. You find that sort of thing on the internet. On the other extreme, no. Jihad is just a matter of the heart. It's a matter of fighting against temptation. It's all psychological, you know. Another interpretation, which I think Tom is alluding to, is this is just war theory. It's the same kind of thing you find in Thomas Aquinas, who is a famous proponent of just war theory. You know, war is permissible, but only under certain restricted conditions. And the one I just read sounds like, and some of the others too I've read, sounds like we're fighting a defensive, we're protecting ourselves, right? Where was I a minute ago? 75 through 77.
Throwing off the oppressors.
Yeah.
But that's not all that was discussed.
No, it's not, but I'm just saying, you know, this is talking about defending the weak, the men, women, and children who say we're being oppressed and that sort of thing. Of course, you could just say, well, of course, that's what people always say. They're always saying they're fighting defensively, even if they're not. I don't know. Okay, but like I say, you be the judge. I mean, I'm just relaying the evidence. All right.
Well, Don, I think it's pretty clear from these passages that this is not an internal struggle, you know, a struggle of the heart to find, you know, Allah or build a relationship or, you know, comply with his directive.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely an external struggle, a physical, you know, it's war.
Mm-hmm. You would have to be a heavy allegorizer to move it over into the internal struggle box.
Right.
Yeah.
But a statement like fighting, the friends of Satan, that normally is not a context you would use for temptation.
Well, that's the guy on your shoulder. He's a friend.
Yeah, I guess. But
yeah.
But it seems to me that you could interpret what we heard so far as a defensive struggle. And there is a fine line between, how defensive is it, and do you go out and meet your enemies because you know they're about to strike you? But that, I haven't exactly heard anything like what I think of as the Crusades. Just you have to spread, Islam far and wide, and go out, and wherever you find unbelievers, strike them down.
Good point. And that's yet another possibility. So that's four possibilities. Well, we need to keep track of this. So one possibility is the critic of Islam saying that this is, you know, Islam is inherently violent. Number two, that's all psychological, the opposite extreme. Number three, this is just war theory. Number four, the crusader kind of thing. You know, it's not a defensive war at all. We've got to use any means whatsoever to spread Islam as far and wide as possible. You know, that's a good point, Pat. And let's add that as our as a fourth possible interpretation. I mean, you know, it's possible. You say you haven't necessarily heard that, but it's you know, maybe it's coming up. Let's see. So the next one is, we're still in surah number four, and this is 85. Fight, therefore, in the cause of Allah. Thou art not made responsible except for thyself, and urge on the believers. It may be that Allah will restrain the might of those that disbelieve, and Allah is stronger in might and stronger in inflicting punishment. Okay. All right. Well, that's okay. I think we'll have to quit after the next one. Say, this is Easter Sunday, so we probably should not go quite too as late as we usually do. 534 is the next one I have written, so let's look at that one. Yes, here we go. The reward of those who wage war against Allah and His Messenger and strive to create disorder in the land is only this, that they be slain or crucified, or their hands and feet be cut off on alternate sides, or that they be expelled from the land. That shall be a disgrace for them in this world, and in the hereafter they shall receive a great punishment. So it's pretty bad. We may have read that one before. It sounds a little bit familiar. I remember this cutting off hands and feet on alternate sides. But anyway, yeah, that's what we do to those who wage war against Allah and His Messenger. All right, well, that's a defensive sort of thing, I guess you could say. Okay, so let's, we did, of the 21, we did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, we did 8, so we did about a little over a third of them. So let's put off the rest for next week. We'll finish up jihad next week. Think about it in the meantime. Maybe we'll have a vote at the end of the class and see what we think about how this needs to be interpreted, or possibly more than one interpretation. Leave that possibility open too. So, does anybody have any last minute comments or anything to make? Okay. Then we'll call it a day for today and see you all next week. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter, Don. Yeah. Thanks.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
Thanks.